Technology can often be polarising. Some people find it creepy and are worried it will steal our jobs. Others are excited about its potential for positive change. But maybe it's up to us how we deploy it. What about you? Are you worried about AI and how it might affect our lives, or happy and excited? Leave a message on our Facebook page. Dr. Sandra Peter is a researcher and educator at the University of Sydney Business School, and she's the director too of Sydney Business Insights, where she leads conversations about the future of business. Sandra, welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, happy to be here.
Let's start with artificial intelligence, which scares a lot of people. Are we right to be worried?
I think artificial intelligence does indeed scare a lot of people, but mostly because many people are quite confused about what it is exactly. So I think it's worth spending a little bit of time just trying to understand what it is. And it's quite simple. Artificial intelligence broadly is a field of study that is just trying to create in computer systems performance similar to that requires human intelligence. And we kind of use AI today as a shorthand to refer to a whole range of technologies, which makes it quite confusing for people. And the most important thing about artificial intelligence today that helps us think about its impact, it's that today it represents a fundamentally different way of doing software technologies. And traditionally, things like artificial intelligence needed us to tell it, to codify, to program into machines everything that we knew so that the computer would be about as smart as we are. We try to embed understanding. So think about trying to teach it to recognize a cat. We would have to describe to the computer everything about that cat, how tall it is, what color it can be. It has four legs. It can be black, white. And then we reached a certain point where we just couldn't describe everything about it. There were the bald cats, that they give to people who have allergies. There were the three-legged cats at the RSPCA and so on. But there have been some massive advances in computational power and increasing data sets. So think about all of us putting pictures of our cats on Instagram and on Facebook, taking pictures of grumpy cats. And what we've done today, so what artificial intelligence does today, is that we have new machine learning systems that rely on neural networks to read all these pictures. We simply gave a million pictures of cats to the computer. We said, these are all cats. You figure out what a cat is.
So it's getting better at doing this machine learning, but that also does sound a little bit worrying. Are we concerned about the right things when it comes to artificial intelligence?
I think we're not really concerned about the right things. So every time someone asks me about artificial intelligence or one of my many colleagues working in this field, they put up a picture of the Terminator next to the column, or they start with, scenarios of Skynet, or they tell us that the world is going to come to an end and they're coming to get us. They are not coming to get us, really, with the types of technologies that we know how to do today. Computers will get better at recognizing patterns. They will get better at prediction. They will get better at image and speech recognition, but they're not coming to get us. However, there are a couple of things that are important to recognize. Things like bias. Because of the way I explained artificial intelligence works, it's only ever as good as the data that we give it. So if we give it a data set that is biased towards a particular type of cats or towards particular segments of the population, then that will be embedded in the data. So say we teach it to read text. The words female and woman are more closely associated in a lot of the written text with arts and humanities occupations or with the home, rather than the words man or male, which are more closely associated to maths and engineering professions. And so a lot of the biases that we have in the types of data that we've gathered historically, whether that's around policing, whether that's around employment or finance, do get translated into that data.
So a machine learning unit might be racist, for example.
The machine itself is not racist, so none of these machines actually think or feel in any way, shape, or form. They can't tell what that cat is. They can recognize an arrangement of pixels or patterns in the data, but they do reproduce the biases that we have in society.
So how widespread is AI and machine learning? Are we perhaps engaging with it in our daily lives already, but not knowing?
Yeah, so I think many of us don't realize just how many of these systems we have around us. And the very simple thing is, if you've engaged with your phone this morning, you've run across many, many of these systems. So things like Siri on your phone, or Alexa, or the predictions you got last, or the suggestions you got last night on your Netflix subscriptions, all of those have algorithms behind that. Every single ad you would have seen on a platform that you've engaged with would have had an algorithm, machine learning algorithm that would have made that suggestion for you. There are also these algorithms in places where you wouldn't necessarily expect them, where we go to get a job, where we're trying to get a loan from the bank. Many of these systems actually use machine learning and use algorithms to suggest an outcome.
And that could be a good outcome or a poor outcome for us, depending on how they've been programmed. Let's talk a little bit about deep fakes, or what people call digital humans. There's an amazing video online that purports to be Barack Obama saying some very sweary and impolitic things, and it's really someone else manipulating footage of him. Tell us how these deep fakes came about, Dr. Sandra Peter.
So you've touched upon one of the other very, very interesting areas. We're actually at the University of Sydney. We do quite a bit of research. MOTUS Lab, which has got my colleagues Kai Rima and Mike Seymour, do cutting-edge research in this space. And they're the types of videos that, like you've seen with Obama, where we can manipulate visual images, or we can manipulate audio, so you can create this with voices as well, to basically pretend to be another person. We've seen this emerge in deepfakes on the internet initially, but we can also now just capture images of people on the street and basically puppeteer them to reproduce voice and images. Many of these deepfakes actually have fantastic applications, and we've seen quite a few of them used by companies to create digital assistants that have a voice. We've used them in medical research. We've used them in medical applications to support, for instance, veterans and so on. But many of these applications are quite scary because of the types of fakes that that we can create. So think about not just creating someone like Barack Obama, but creating thousands and thousands of fake people who are actually asking the representative for a certain outcome in the next round of legislation.
And this has massive implications for where we place our trust, doesn't it? Does this mean that traditional media, at least, needs to get really, really good at debunking the fakes before we can place our trust in it again?
Of course, it's always going to be an arms race, right? There are people who make these fakes, and there are also a lot of universities who are currently working on trying to catch these fakes. But media, I think, has a more important role than ever in this sort of instances. It is actually really well-curated media that can help us overcome these fakes. So not trusting everything that we see on Facebook, not promoting videos that seem extreme. I think media actually has a very important role to play.
Let's talk some more about the positives. I think we're all hungry for positives about artificial intelligence. And in the health field, I understand that there have been some great advances.
Yeah, so if you recall what I said about recognizing patterns, you can imagine that in medical applications, this has created some tremendously good applications. So if you think about recognizing tumors, or recognizing any types of diseases where we have really good data, we have x-rays, we have CAT scans, we have MRIs, this has been a tremendous development. So places like John Hopkins Medicine in Baltimore has an algorithm for detecting pancreatic cancer, for instance, and they're doing wonderful research in that space because we have really good, well-labeled data for that we can feed these machines. There are many other good applications. I mean, I've mentioned Siri and Alexa and Amazon and Netflix. Of course, these are commercial applications. But think about autonomous vehicles. And when I think about autonomous vehicles, I'm not thinking the next Tesla all of us are hoping to buy, but I'm thinking autonomous vehicles, for instance, in mining, in dangerous situation, autonomous machines that are in ports, autonomous machines that you might have in agriculture that actually save us a lot of labor and help us do really difficult jobs.
But that's a big thing for a lot of people, isn't it? They're worried that those jobs that have been done and are being done by people with limited employment opportunities might be whisked away from them and given to machines.
And absolutely. And that's been a huge, an absolutely huge conversation over the last few years. There have been many, many studies, and I think we've all seen the headlines. 40% of our jobs will disappear. 60% of our jobs will disappear. And I think we need to analyze that conversation a bit more critically. First is to say that just because all of those jobs can disappear, it doesn't mean that they will disappear. We can actually automate a lot of the tasks that we're doing today with things, we don't need artificial intelligence for that. We already have ways of automating, and that hasn't happened yet in all the jobs. The second is, I think a more nuanced conversation in that space is really, really helpful. So if we think about the types of tasks we can automate versus the types of jobs, if we think about the nature of jobs that we can automate, I think an important question to ask there is, where will these jobs disappear? Because there is indeed some concern about the types of jobs that will disappear and the fact that those jobs will disappear increasingly in rural areas where we already have seen a lot of jobs go, where we can automate things much easier than we can in the cities, where people interact with other people a lot more. And there's also a polarization of jobs that might be not just geographic, but also social. If you think about a lot of the jobs where we do analytics that we can automate, whether that involves using spreadsheets, and this is in finance, or whether it's a lot of data, again, we start feeding it a lot of data helps. If we think about what a lawyer would do, certain types of jobs will disappear. And thinking about how that would impact society as a whole is quite important.
And these really big ethical and social conversations, as you say, are so important. One of the questions in that realm is, who is funding AI? Is the technology emerging from the public sector or the private?
That's a very interesting question. And I always start by telling people that if you look at most of the technology that went into our smartphones today, a lot of it was government-funded research that came out of universities or came out of government research. If we look at the big investments in AI today, the picture is actually quite different. If we look at places like the U.S., companies like Alphabet or Google, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Microsoft invested about $60 billion in research and development, most of it in AI. The U.S. federal government invested that much money in all non-military research. So that's cancer research, that's going to the moon, everything else. So only about $1 billion in unclassified AI research. Samsung, one company, is investing $22 billion over the next 3 years. In Australia, we're investing about $30 million in the last budget in AI. And of course, there's the other side of the story. If you look at China, the four big Chinese tech companies have been involved in about $12 billion worth of investments or acquisitions in the AI space. And that is big, even compared to their big U.S. rivals, to Amazon, Apple, and Facebook, who've only been part of about $1.7 billion worth of deals in the AI space. So a lot of this will come from the private tech sector, which is why it's so important for us to get involved in the conversations around how these technologies enter our collective lives.
Yes. Well, Dr. Sandra Peter, who are the people in those rooms now having those conversations about how AI will be deployed?
That's always an interesting question because, you know, who are the people involved and who should be the people involved? I think it's been an increasingly diverse field where a lot of social scientists, a lot of psychologists, a lot of philosophers have entered the field because remember, this has been an engineering-driven initiative. So quite early on, there were a lot of engineers who then turned out to be social engineers through the products that they were building. So we're increasingly seeing diverse voices. In Australia, you're seeing, for instance, from the University of Sydney, people from across all the faculties getting involved in this conversation, increasingly from the business school as well. And you're also seeing people getting more and more involved. So we're seeing critical voices emerge from also the space of employees. So employees at Google, for instance, have walked out asking Google not to be involved in AI research that is used for military purposes. You've seen people at other other companies protest against the use of AI that is biased against women for hiring decisions and so on. So I think the really critical role is that we all start participating in that conversation.
Yeah, we're going to need a really big round table. Just in our final 60 seconds, Dr. Sandra Peter, who's accountable for AI at the moment? What happens when something goes wrong?
I think that is a space that we are still very much at the beginning of trying to figure it out. So, for instance, very simple questions like who is accountable when an autonomous vehicle is involved in an accident are still yet to be decided. And actually, part of this conversation are not just regulators and lawmakers and the people who build these technologies, but also us as consumers and us as people who use these services, whether they be online services or whether they be products and services that we use in our everyday life. So I think in terms of accountability, again, I would urge everyone out there listening to get knowledgeable in this space and to participate in the conversation, because through our use of those technologies, we are all involved.
I will add that to my to-do list for the week. Dr. Sandra Peter, thank you so much for exploring it with us on Life Matters today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sandra Peter is the director of Sydney Business Insights, which has grown out of the University of Sydney Business School and leads conversations about the future of business. She's a researcher and educator at University of Sydney. This is Life Matters. Next on Teen Matters, one of our guests reveals what it was like to meet a person who bullied him at school 50 years after the act. You're on RN.